to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwindiger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some cybersecurity news and headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis that you can take back to your office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Hey, Matt, did you know that there's a new law on Druidia banning default passwords on IoT devices?
I'm going to have to change the password. That's all right. It's the same as my luggage. It's super easy to remember. Article one. This one's mine. The article title is What You Need to Remember When Choosing a Managed Service Provider, and it's by Tripwire. And honestly, we can talk about a couple of these things, but the biggest reason that I picked this one is I know, David, you and I have talked quite a bit in the past about how we think that kind of the hybrid SOC model is really the future for most companies, where you're outsourcing your tier one at least and maybe other parts of the SOC. Summarizing what's in the article, super, super quick before we get to the more interesting part. The big thing is, the big thing you need to start off with is know what you need and what's on the network, what's your biggest challenges, what does the MSP need to be doing? For example, you could just outsource the tier one SOC function, the analyst function. You could outsource the SIEM. You could outsource the network engineering. There's all kinds of things you can outsource. So that's obviously your first thing. Then when you're looking over the various MSPs, MSSPs, there are four factors you want to look at. You want to look at the cost primarily. You can always do what they did at a previous company that I worked for, where you do a whole big RFP and really get involved and really deep into it and then just choose the cheapest one. Seems to be popular. You need to look at the different ways that it costs. It may cost based on number of events you ingest versus the number of people employed versus the number of endpoints versus the amount of content provided. So different MSPs will charge you differently. And even if the number that they give you back in the RFP looks different, it may not be once you look at, getting new log sources in may increase your cost, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and part of that new log sources increasing your cost may be the cost of normalizing that log source for their own custom SIEM, which a lot of these MSSPs used. So they don't just connect to any old tool and, it's done right away. There's some of these charge professional services to onboard a log source that they've never done before.
That makes sense. Yeah. And then having a large change in a number of endpoints or something may be a problem too. For example, if you start doing inventory and discover there's whole swaths of the companies you never counted, that can certainly be a potential issue versus what you think you have versus the other. Finally, never forget, even if the MSSP says that they do everything, they don't really do everything. You still need people to review. I feel like this is a problem I've definitely seen before, where the MSP is hired and brought on and they don't bring in people to catch the alerts they're throwing over. They don't bring in people to field kind of the engineering notifications like, oh, this data source has dropped. Somebody needs to go look at and figure out what's happening with this data source.
But so where do those messages go? They don't even send them to IT?
Well, that's what they would do. They'd send it to like the help desk or something, but you need somebody that understands what to do with those alerts. You can't just outsource your whole security department.
And you're disappointing some people with that statement.
Sorry. Other factors that you need to keep in mind is dedicated support. That's a big one in terms of, again, especially if you do outsource all those people, how do you get help when you don't know how to handle an alert? Their maturity and their reporting and ability to prove value. Their default reports are usually terrible. They all have that stupid funnel where they're like 20 million events, which funnels down to 1,000 alerts, of which, 600 were reviewed and it was 7 true positives. So it's a great report of how busy they are, but busyness is not an appropriate measure of security.
Yeah, and there are ways to manipulate those numbers for them on their side too, if they wanted to.
Never.
I'm not saying they would. I'm just saying it's possible, of course.
So the first discussion point that I had down here was, of course, kind of what we talked about before. I think that you and I agree that the SOC of the future is going to be some level of hybrid, mostly because the tier one function is extremely painful and it's kind of expensive.
Yeah, I think there are other advantages to the overall community as well by more organizations adopting this model. Because if you outsource your tier one to an MSSP, that's going to incentivize them to do more work on AI and automation. At least this is my thoughts on it. Kind of, I don't know if laying the groundwork is exactly right, but I think you're going to see you could see a lot of innovation started coming out of these MSSPs who are doing level one monitoring and are doing automation along with that, that will then filter out into other organizations in the broader security community.
Yeah, that makes sense. Definitely should help out in things like detecting earlier and stuff like that. Also allows you to keep kind of the fun stuff in-house too. Nobody likes doing the tier one SOC work, and a good tier one should be moving on in, 6 to 12 months probably from there. We don't want them crushed. I guess we don't want anybody crushed under that workload, but I think the real question then is not whether you insource or outsource. The question is, what do you outsource? So I think definitely tier one should probably be outsourced, but the rest of these that I have listed, especially David's job in the notes, is the question of what do we outsource?
Well, I won't save them much money.
Damn. All right. So thoughts on tiers two and three? Like the more advanced SOC work, of course, being a former tier two and three analyst, I do believe that we should keep that. But
Well, I think those two are the two definites I think should remain. Now, forensics and malware analysis, I think those are obviously points for outsourcing because those are two things that you aren't going to do all the time. And if you have someone who's got that skill set and they're not doing that all the time, what else are they going to be doing? And that's going to discourage them, because if that's their area of expertise and they're only doing it on occasion, and other times they're doing other stuff that's outside of that, they may become disgruntled and move on, and you got to find someone else to replace them anyway.
Yeah, that's definitely a question that is kind of unaddressed around the training aspect. Because most SOCs, people start off in the tier one and they move to tier two, and then they go deeper into IR, they go over to engineering or whatever. And if you cut out the whole SOC, you lose some of that pipeline. What about the security engineering function? They're not doing anything important, are they?
Oh, other than making sure all your tools are running. that really depends on your level of outsourcing. If you're outsourcing the tool functional management, it may make sense to outsource the other management, but a lot of security engineering actually requires a great deal of interaction with backend IT in the organization. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure even then it makes a whole lot of sense for the MSSP to take that on, because then they're going to have to go in and interact with your IT for change control and things of that nature, which I don't think makes a lot of sense.
Gotcha. Yeah. And part of that too is some of the MSSPs, for example, can't really do much to help you there. They are very remote. They put a box in your network to ingest alerts, and they don't really touch your infrastructure, versus some that, log in and have VPN access and can come in and do stuff. I know one of the struggles we've had in the past with the royal we with MSPs is them not knowing necessarily or not following your change windows and trying to mesh their processes and schedules with your processes and schedules.
Mm-hmm.
So, seen a lot of trouble with that. I have seen some companies do the outsourcing the SIEM. That one is, it's hit and miss. It's nice to have a dedicated, MSP resource where you can reach out on the SIEM. But on the other hand, they still need a lot of access into your environment. And if you don't provide them that access or not comfortable providing them that access, you still need people on your side to be their hands, reviewing the log source failures, figuring out why the logging's not going on, figuring out what broke, maybe making the changes and installing patches, stuff like that.
Right. And something to consider, depending on how you work, how the MSSP operates or what you're having them do for you, is the portability of your data as it's associated with the MSSP. Because if you have one MSSP and you're relying on them for log management and SIEM, you know, what happens when you decide you want to move to another MSSP and they've created alerts or other data management stuff within those tools, you know, how can you keep that, or are you even, based on your contract with the MSSP, do you even own that data, or does that belong to the MSSP now? And how do you transition that to another MSSP? I mean, do you just drop it and then start with a new MSSP and all that, the old data is gone then? And then you don't have 13 months of back data for the MSSP to investigate if they find something, or, you know, how, consider all that in your conversation with an MSSP to start with, just in case that relationship doesn't work out and you need to move to another one. Because I know one MSSP I talked to, they actually were using Splunk Cloud, and the customer owned the Splunk Cloud instance. And at the termination of the contract, the customer then just took over that cloud instance and they could move it to another MSSP or pull it in-house or whatever they wanted to at that time.
That's cool. Yeah, that's I've seen it before as well, where you or the MSSP will own the content. And that's definitely if you have a black box MSSP where they stick the box on the network, they tell you to push the logs there, then you don't own any of the content. And if you decide to get rid of the MSSP, you're starting from scratch. You've got nothing. But if you work with the MSSP and make sure it's in the contract, especially if they're co-managing the SIEM or completely managing your SIEM where you own the content that's in there, then even if you decide that their, you know, engineering and their other things are not great, you still have the ability to have some content of your own. So it's not a complete loss when you get rid of them, when you throw them to the curb.
In that situation, you're gonna get some loss anyway, I think, some knowledge loss anyhow, because in the course of the MSSP doing that work, they're gonna learn things about the organization that your security team might not know. And they're going to take that information with them when the MSSP goes, unless you're getting regular reports or some kind of shared document repository as well for knowledge-based stuff.
And then the final set we have here is the malware analysis and forensics. And frankly, most companies have already kind of outsourced those simply by, you know, bringing in somebody like Mandiant or Verizon to handle that. And that kind of makes sense. I used to really want to do deep dive forensics, and then I found out that most companies don't have that function in-house. Big financial firms tend to, and, you know, some healthcare and some stuff like that, but a lot of companies don't.
Yeah, those are rare activities.
Fair enough.
All right, so the second article. It's all about the survival of the fittest. CISOs must be brave enough to throw away their security playbook or suffer the consequences. And this comes to us from The Register. And that title is actually pretty misleading because they don't tell you a whole lot in the article.
Yeah, this article, this is one of my least favorite kind of new article creation in the modern day where they're trying to just generate content all the time. It accurately diagnoses a problem and then tells you almost nothing about how to fix it.
Well, that's something I wanted to talk about this article. And then one of the reasons that I picked it actually is that at the very top of the article, the article itself is tagged with advertorial from Vectra. So this is an article written by the CISO of Vectra. That provides AI security tools. And it's just basically convincing you that you need AI security tools.
But it didn't even do that well.
No. I mean, it was almost a throwaway line at the very bottom. The whole article is almost entirely fluff. But at the top, just to summarize what they're saying here is that and we'll get into some of this other, we'll comment on this in a second, but being a CISO is not about preventing attacks. It's about detecting and responding. Playing it safe and using old playbook technology like IDS doesn't match modern adversaries. Now, to start off with, the whole thing about CISO's job is not about preventing attacks. I think that's a misstatement. I would say a CISO's job is not only about preventing attacks. But if you are not, if part of your job is not dedicated towards prevention, then, you know, you have the completely wrong mindset about what security is supposed to do. It's not all about response. Just using the simple analogy, you don't fail to put locks on your door because, you know, well, someone's going to break in anyway, so why bother? We just need to be prepared with the shotgun once the door opens. So I think it's a completely misstated claim there at the very beginning anyway. And it puts people, it puts people in the wrong mindset about how to do security. Sure, you can say it's not all about prevention, which is absolutely true. And that's the way you should couch it. You can't prevent everything. And it's more about, setting the expectations for leadership in your overall organization that perfect security is not possible. Mm-hmm. And then further down the article, they talk about how leadership expects you to put in IDS or IPS because these tools are tried and tested. That actually got me thinking about, sure, there's no place I've ever been which did not have an IDS or an IPS. But really, until the advent of attack simulation, there's been really not a lot of proof or evidence that these are really good technologies that everybody has to have anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. The false positive rate is just so high.
Yeah. You get a lot of anecdotal data, especially from pen testers on, oh yeah, that's great. And that's not great. And you see some experiential data from attackers. I think one of the APTs recently, or one of the big things that ran around recently, shut down if it saw, you know, CrowdStrike or Mandiant or Carbon Black. So you can get kind of some things from that and get a better idea of what IDSs are better, host-based or network-based. But yeah, up until breach simulation, it was very difficult to, no company had the time to consistently test.
Right. So they're saying, well, you need to replace your legacy tools with solutions that fit better in a data-centric security model and give you better value for your money overall.
Drink.
Yep, which means you need to get an AI detection tool.
Of course. You know what? It's funny. You mentioned that was like a throwaway line at the end. I read over this article and I totally even missed that.
Yeah. I mean, this is something else with this whole idea here that is a mistake also, is given that this is supposed to be basically an advertisement. Like, what was that term again? Advertorial. And this, anybody in your marketing department will tell you the CISO should not be writing copy.
He may not have, though. He may not have written this.
I mean, if the marketing team wrote this copy, then they are terrible. You need to fire them right now. Oof. Because this did not lead me to think that I need to go and talk to Vector or look into them at all. Mm-hmm. It's just terrible. In summary, don't read this article. It's a waste of your time.
You know, I may not even put a link to it in the show notes.
But do make sure that your leadership does have an expectation about, you know, what you can do for security, that you aren't going to be able to prevent everything. There is going to be a necessity for response.
Article number 3.5 security intelligence must-haves for next-gen attack surface management. This is actually a white paper. That being said, I didn't even sign up for the white paper. I just thought that it might be worth discussing the 5 summary points, and it was kind of cool.
I agree. I think these are fantastic.
Yeah, and who knows? Maybe the rest of the paper is really good, too. Know yourself, attack surface intelligence. Having complete visibility into each asset and connection across your digital footprint is vital. I agree. And in fact, we discussed attack surface monitoring, I think, a couple months ago. I think it's a really cool new tool where, for anybody that doesn't know what it is, you should obviously go back and listen to our whole back catalog. But if you don't, it's a variation on a vulnerability scanner, kind of. They start off with your main website, or you give them a list of websites or IP addresses. Then they spider off of that website using things like who owns the IP range, who registered the domain name, what the certificates are used, like where else are the certificates used, what links off of the website, and it gives you a really good idea kind of what all you have in your externally facing for your environment. The big gap there is frequently if, you know, somebody stood up something with a credit card that may not get pulled into this, but.
You know, one thing I would mention that doesn't really tie itself into attack service stuff about know yourself though, is understanding how different parts of your business interact with the internet. For instance, if you're in a financial institution that does mortgages, then you have to expect that your mortgage department is going to be exchanging PDFs and documents with completely unknown people all the time. And take that into account about how you're going to protect that part of the business with secure email, secure document transfer. If your HR department is going to get unsolicited resumes, you know, how are you going to secure those in case there's malware in resume files? Mm-hmm. You know, whether it be documents with macros or PDFs that are malware or whatever. That's part of what you should also understand about know yourself in an organization as well.
And that's tough for that's frequently tough for these types of tools to figure out. The big add-on there that makes attack surface intelligence a little more than just vulnerability scanning is both the fact that it spiders in a different way. Usually with vulnerability scanners, you have to load it with all the IP addresses you want it to scan. And second, the prioritization they give. A lot of these vendors will put a lot of verbiage into, we've got an attack team that'll tell you, you know, which ones are the worst, and we don't just go by CVE score, et cetera, et cetera.
Actually, weren't you saying before that spidering also kind of leads into the next bullet here?
Well, I mean, I think that's
interesting. About know your allies.
Well, that's kind of that's like Security Scorecard is a big vendor that does that. It's similar to the attack surface management, but it's a slightly different product. I don't know. I know you're familiar with Security Scorecard, where they give like a letter mm-hmm. grade based on, yep. you know, if they're detecting malware, transmitting hour, and again, vulnerability scan results and things like certificate security. The Venn diagram there definitely overlaps. Second bullet, like you said, know your allies. That's especially these days where everybody's networks are so interconnected. At this point, everybody knows that Target was breached because of a third party. And I'm sure that happens frequently for many other connected companies these days.
Right. And those third parties are also your SaaS providers mm-hmm. or your PaaS providers as well.
Or they're managing your websites, or they're your MSSP, or who knows where. We were just discussing now they've got VPN access in your environment. We saw one with Kaseya, where they broke into the MSP and then mm-hmm. immediately went out. And there was another one with another MSP a couple of years ago where it was the same thing. They broke in and got an admin account for a user at this MSP who provided help desk like support. And they just RDP'd into all the customers and dropped malware on there with a PowerShell script. So know your enemy, cyber threat intelligence. This is included, and frankly, this white paper is from RiskIQ. They're an attack surface management vendor, so this makes sense. This is that part I mentioned before with the attack surface vendors where they're trying to say that they're more valuable than a regular vulnerability scanner because they have, you know, more knowledge about what kinds of attacks are worse. Sure. That's always, frankly, to me, that always seems to be the least important part of the threat intelligence. Because just because APT1 is doing it this way doesn't mean you get to ignore, you know, macros and the other things that APT1 doesn't do. It's kind of related to what you're talking about a minute ago, David, about you can't just ignore prevention. You don't, just because threat intel says one group is targeting you and they're doing things one way doesn't mean you get to just not be like, they don't use phishing, so we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, I think the threat intel is really about, it's more a prioritization exercise. Than really a do this, do that, or do this, don't do that kind of scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. If you've got, because, you know, every security department's got a giant list, I get that does make sense that, you know, if this APT targets you and they specialize in, you know, web server compromise, you may want to, if you're not monitoring those yet, you would probably want to move that up your list. Point number four, know your ever-changing surroundings, security operations intelligence. I'm not 100% sure what this one is. Extended enterprise intelligence? Is this around things you were talking about before, about like the HR stuff and how other people are using?
I think it might be that, but I think this may be more along the lines of what we talked about last week with continuous validation. Where you understand how your network is changing, how your architecture is changing as time goes on.
Gotcha.
But I think that also ties into new business solutions as well, as part of that change in your IT architecture. You know, we were talking just a second ago about the mortgage department. So if they bring on a new document exchange platform, you know, understanding how that works and how that's secured, and hopefully gotcha. Have some say in that decisioning if they don't pick something, so they don't pick something terrible.
That makes sense. All right. And the last point of the five, vulnerability intelligence, identify which vulnerabilities matter, how critical they are, and how to align all the teams in your organizations. I don't think that their platform is going to help on that last one. But again, this is kind of old school vulnerability management stuff. I don't know if there's anything special to go through in here.
Yeah. Just make sure you're doing it. I was just going to say, and actually doing vulnerability management, not just vulnerability assessment.
And it's funny. Because that was one of the first things I did. I think we've talked before. My first security job was auditing, and my second security job was vulnerability management. Back when I was just so new that I didn't know how anything worked. And that's
right where
terrible,
you need to be.
I know, right? Like that's not the best place for a new security person is telling the Windows admins, you know, which things to patch first. Because I didn't know what I was doing. I was basically just going off CVE score and that's it. But again, like more experienced professionals don't want to do those jobs because those jobs suck.
Right. It goes back to, you know, automating that stuff away.
Yep.
Or outsourcing it to an MSSP.
Yeah. All right. So one of the things I thought was interesting about this article is RiskIQ has an attack surface management product. It says next gen attack surface management, which is funny. They're talking about next gen attack surface management when first gen attack surface management hasn't really caught on yet, but whatever. I just thought it was really interesting. Some of these were definitely things that are in there, but the security operations intelligence, lumping that in was a little interesting. I don't know. It just seemed cool to me.
Yeah, I really like this, the 5-point framework that they outline here. And I think I actually am going to go and get that white paper and see what else they have to say.
All right. Email it to me so I don't have to put my
your information in there.
They probably already have it, actually.
Because I think this is really kind of an expanse on Sun Tzu's know yourself and know your enemy.
You shall never lose a battle.
Well, you should never fear the outcome of 100 battles.
My bad. I obviously don't know my Sun Tzu.
Terrible. A lot of people get that one wrong, and I have in the past too, which is why I know it better now.
That's fair.
But yeah, it's really an expanse on that. You know, knowledge is power. You better understand yourself and better understand those that are better attempting to attack you or are attacking you, then the more likely you're going to have success in your defense. And if that law comes to pass, maybe better success in your offense. Speaking of laws, the next one is a new law will issue bans, fines, for using default passwords on smart devices. And this is from the Malwarebytes blog. And apparently there is a bill before Parliament in the UK, which is called the Product Security and Telecommunications Infrastructure Bill. And it's to ensure that IoT devices meet a minimum level of security and are going to require manufacturers, importers, and distributors to comply with security requirements relating to consumer-connected products. And they're going to create an enforcement regime with both civil and criminal sanctions, although I could not find any good information on what the criminal sanctions are, to prevent insecure products from being made available in the UK market.
That's
interesting. So this is just proposed in the House of Commons, which has just done its first reading, which is the first step in what looks to be a very long and arduous process. So it goes through 5 steps in the House of Commons and then 7 more in the House of Lords. And if you like reading and understanding more about bureaucracy, there's a link in the show notes to this process on how a bill becomes a law in the UK.
Oh man, I am right into that.
Oh yeah, it's riveting.
I'm surprised to hear about the criminal penalties. I was expecting civic penalties for sure, but criminal, send you to jail who goes to jail? The person that approved it, the CEO of the company?
I'm not sure. So I pulled that from this is not from the article. This is from the frequently asked questions page or the fact page on the UK government's website about this bill, which talks about civil and criminal sanctions. And the bill, which is also will also be linked in the show notes, is 66 pages of legalese, which I was not fully intending to read the whole thing. I skimmed through it, and what I read was painful to behold. So I think that the lawyers that write UK's laws are even worse than lawyers that write US law. So if you want to suffer through that, by all means, go ahead and do so. But I did not see anything in there specifically about criminal sanctions outlined in the bill itself. And some of the talking points they put forth on, you know, why this bill is necessary is apparently 49% of UK residents purchased at least one smart device since the start of the pandemic. So half the country has purchased a smart device in the last 18 months.
You know, I'm not a resident of the UK, but I myself have purchased smart bulbs recently.
Oh, and you actually hooked them up to your Wi-Fi?
Yep. Although I'm told I shouldn't have been using the Wi-Fi. I should have been using a hub, but that was too complicated. I just wanted to dip my toes.
There are obviously smart ways to do that by putting all your IoT on a separate subnet.
Yep.
And isolating it off from your home production network.
Mm-hmm.
If you do a search for, I probably mentioned this podcast way too much, but Steve Gibson's podcast a couple of years ago did a talk on what he called 3 dumb routers, I think, or 2 dumb routers. We talked about a way to use, you know, not use VLANs, but use just simple routers, you know, home routers in order to be able to do IoT isolation. Actually, I'll look that up and we'll put that as a link in the show notes as well on how you can do that isolation.
Yeah, my router comes with a separate functionality for IoT where it stands up a separate network for you.
Is that, so it does like an internal, an IoT and a guest network, or is it the IoT?
Well, it is a guest network. The IoT is the guest network.
Okay.
So, but it specifically calls it out. Yeah.
Something that can be challenging if you need parts of your production network to talk to your IoT network. For instance, if you have a NAS that has like Plex on it,
mm-hmm.
and you want to be able to manage that NAS from your production network, but you don't want to have that be, you know, because it's IoT, you don't want it on your production network. So yeah, depends on how complicated your network is and how the type of devices on you have on it, about the level of complexity and how you're going to manage that goes. But one of the other things they talked about as well is that they forecast that there could be up to 50 billion connected products worldwide by 2030. And on average, each household in the UK will have at least 9 of these devices. So you can imagine if a botnet got a hold of 50 billion connected devices. Man, forget about it. You know, if they did anything but mine cryptocurrency, they'd be stupid. Anyway, so they're putting forth this so that the ministers will have the power to specify and amend minimum security requirements in relation to these consumer connected devices. And some of the things they listed in on here is easy to guess passwords by default, preloaded on devices are banned. And all products now need unique passwords that cannot be set to factory default. So I think this is probably the most problematic statement within the entire thing. Because if they do this, they enforce this, and you get a new security device, right? And it doesn't have a factory default. Is it still going to have a factory reset on it? So that if you forget the password of the device or something happens, that you are going to be able to get back into the device once you've done a factory reset on it. It might be possible, because the thing is, if they do that, they have to include documentation with the device that says, oh, here's your randomly generated password. Absolutely do not lose this password.
Yeah.
Because if you do, no one else on the entire planet has it. And if you lose it, you're going to have to throw your device out and get a new one.
Whew. Yeah, that's so pretty rough.
So they have to have some way to do password resets anyway. I know, you know, I've done it more than once on some of the IoT stuff that I've had. Factory reset, you know, use the default password, go in and reset, you know, go in and update the credentials to new credentials. And, you know, whatever, I can't remember the specific instances where that was at, but if I had to do that and then had lost that password, that device is basically a brick now. There's nothing you can do about it. So they mm-hmm. have to have some method to reset the password. Now, if they don't have it, so you can factory reset it to a default password, which comes with the box, you know, are they going to have something set up for the customers to contact the vendor in order to figure out the password or something? So if they do that, there's, you know, two other problems that I can see there. Number one, you're going to get increased support calls to do this password reset thing. Or, well, actually, there's more than that. I guess number one would be that, you know, if they're going to do a randomly generated password for each unique device that they produce, then they're going to have some mechanism for doing that, which probably means some algorithm to generate the password. And depending on how that's configured, it might be possible for someone to figure out that algorithm and then know all the passwords anyway, because they're able to generate the passwords themselves. Or they're going to have a mechanism where people have to call in to get their password reset or find out what the password is. Or they're going to have to set up some online mechanism for self-service for people to go in and get their new password or find out what the original password was, which is then leads to another avenue of attack for attackers to get into the devices or attack them via a different way. So I think this is going to lead to more problems than it solves. Well, I don't know about that necessarily, but it's going to lead to a huge amount of problems with this by forcing a unique password for these. See, next point, customers must be told when they buy the device, the minimum time they will receive security updates and patches. And if the product is not going to get any, they also need to be notified of that. I think that's all well and good. I think they should have gone, what would have been something better to add in here in addition to that, would have been to have auto updates turned on by default. And then if someone wanted to go in and disable those auto updates, they could. Because most people are not even going to think about doing the updates anyway. So sure, they're going to say, you're going to get a minimum security updates for the next 5 years. But if a end user has to manually apply those updates, it might as well be zero for the vast majority of people.
Yeah. Yep. I can tell you if my router's ever auto updated. That's actually a good question.
I've had to do mine manually. So, you know, and something else would have been on here is they need to have a mechanism for notifying users of updates when they're available, when they happen. Because again, the updates could be available for 5 years. But unless the users know to go in and actually do the update, because they're not going to be scheduled like every month or something like that. They're all, at least in prior experience, they're all ad hoc.
Yeah. And they can't do an auto update thing where they push it out and force it. Cause if they screw that up and it bricks everybody's routers or whatever, or light bulbs.
Well, they just need to do proper testing and then not do fly by night firmware upgrades or whatever.
Yeah. You say that, but what are they going to do? They're just going to roll it out.
Well, then they need to have something they should have put in this thing is then an easier mechanism for customers to get retribution from the vendors. Maybe retribution is a bad term to use.
I was thinking, pound of flesh.
Compensation from the vendors who, through their negligence, cause problems with their IoT devices.
Yeah. So how would you suggest that they fix this issue then? Is this still on the whole better that they're forcing unique passwords, or should they leave it so that people still do that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 BS passwords?
Well, I think it would have been better to, I think it's probably a better thing to leave the default password, but have a forcing mechanism in the configuration of the device. And so you can't get it to work without changing the password. And if people want to use shitty passwords, they can use shitty passwords. Well, I mean, you could put, well, I mean, this is a broader conversation about the challenges with passwords in general, but you could put controls on there to say they can't put in the password must be 10 to 12 characters. And, you can have those kind of criteria built into the firmware as well. When they've changed the password, it must meet certain criteria. Mm-hmm. But if you do that, then they're going to write it down and lose it or whatever. But as long as they had the ability to go back and do their factory reset back to the default, they could still recover that device and go back in there. So I think, like a lot of crap the government puts out, I think it's a good, it sounds good in concept, but in execution, it's not going to work. And I think, it's going to lead to a lot of problems in general across the entire IoT market. Because when you talk about the UK, if this, this is, like I said, this is step one of a 12-step process. I'm not saying it's even going to get through the entire 12-step process to become a law in the UK. But if it does, because they talked about manufacturers, importers, and distributors could be held liable, that means like Amazon, I'm not sure if Walmart sells overseas, but any international organization that imports products into the UK is going to be liable to this. And they're not going to have a split mechanism where they say, oh, we're going to do this for UK devices, but we're not going to do this for US devices, or we're not going to do this for Japanese devices. So regardless of the country, this is going to become de facto standard for all these large manufacturers across the entire globe. And the fines that they're talking about in here are not insignificant. They talk about 10 million pounds or 4% of global earnings, whichever is larger, could be imposed for failure to adhere to this law. So, which tells me, two things. One, that's a large incentive for companies not to run afoul of this. And two, large companies have huge pools of lawyers who will fight this in court for a long time, should this ever actually be attempted to be leveraged against the company.
And this is very much like California, right? Where California pushes up something, and then the rest of people that sell in the US have to do it because California is such a big market.
Right. That's why everything you buy says, in the state of California, I must warn you, this causes cancer.
Because they all do in California.
They all do, according to California. Yeah. I'm not sure I should be drinking from this cup. Probably causes cancer in California. But if it just causes cancer in California, maybe because I'm not in California, I'm safe.
Yep. Good thing I'm not drinking this in California.
Yep. My bottom line take on this is I don't expect this to pass. It's just the very tip of a very long process. And because of some of these problems that I just talked about, I don't. I think there's going to be a lot of people leveraged against this, and I'd much rather see an international standards body come up with something better. Like, you know, because there's an international standard for why are all USB the same? You know, the government doesn't have to regulate and say all USB must conform to this. You know, international organizations of electronics came together and said, hey, this is mutually beneficial for all of us to adhere to the standard. And there are elements of this already going on now anyway. And I think that's a much better outcome for this instead. And really, companies like Apple or other hardware vendors who are very security focused or privacy focused need to call out that discrepancy between the way they do security business and the way other companies do security business. And start pressuring everybody to come to some level of understanding to increase the security of IoT. But anyway, there are so many devices already on the network, right? Already out there for IoT, even if they pass this, it's still, there are going to be a huge number of IoT that are completely unaffected by this.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Next article is, this is a short one. I just thought it was something that was real cool and I wanted to make everybody aware of it. It's called The Pitfall of Threat Intelligence Whitelisting. Spectre botnet is taking over top legit DNS domains by using cloud DNS service. It's from NetLab at 360.com, which honestly, I don't even know what that is, but it is a very cool little methodology for an attacker to use what looks like a totally legitimate domain for their command and control. In this instance, they found that this particular malware sample was beaconing out to what appeared to be api.github.com. It's just another way of hiding your command and control traffic amongst the regular traffic. Now, the way that this worked is the attacker, so apparently the cloud DNS service allows you to register other legitimate domains and subdomains. So they registered api.github.com in this cloud DNS service and then pointed it to their command and control server. And then when they resolved it and forced it to use a cloud DNS provider. So instead of resolving to the normal api.github.com IP address, it resolved to the one that they registered on cloud DNS.
So if I understand this correctly, then basically the way normal DNS works is, you know, you have the authoritative DNS server, which, you know, you register the domain with the IP and that gets propagated to other DNS servers because they come back and do the authoritative resolve to your DNS server. So eventually whoever wants that IP gets it by going through the recursive DNS back to your authoritative. But the way that this cloud works is this is not recursive or authoritative. It's only if you specify the cloud DNS as the resolver, yep, do you get the result you want, right?
That's correct. Yeah, because everybody else will go to the actual one because it's not authoritative. So, and what's that's how the, they... Oh, go ahead.
I don't understand the technical use case for these guys even existing then.
I don't know either. Cloud DNS, you mean? Yeah. I don't know. Frankly, this looks like just an oversight to me. They just didn't anticipate people using it this way. And I'm sure it's, by the time this is out, I'm sure that this is no longer going to be possible. But it does illustrate that if you're looking at your DNS, one of the things, especially as I imagine most mid-sized to large companies already do, they already centralize their DNS. You have, you know, all of your workstations are supposed to go to an internal DNS resolver. And then if it can't find anything in there that's cached, then it goes out. So all your DNS stuff should be going out via a known set of servers. So this is definitely something you may want to look at, is looking for people trying to use other DNS resolvers.
Right. Yeah. Your network should be configured that way anyway.
Yep.
But you know, the way that I first read this was that I thought what they were doing was they were using the GitHub API to do the resolution. The request would look like it's going to GitHub, but GitHub was actually doing the lookup to something else.
You know, that wouldn't surprise me though, using something like AWS Lambda or something. to do C2 where you're running a function on one of the serverless architectures. I bet you could do something like that. And it wouldn't surprise me also if there were network resolution APIs that allowed you to kind of proxy DNS resolutions.
Hmm.
There's probably a couple different ways you can do something similar to that, although maybe not with api.github.com.
Yeah. It's kind of annoying that some fun problems to solve are on the bad guy side.
It's definitely worth taking a look at this article and picking out those four different IP addresses. They checked the top 1 million fully qualified domain names. I don't know if they used Alexa or something else, but they found there were 192 malicious domain registrations. So apparently Cloud DNS has four IP addresses in the article. It's probably worth, you know, going through some historical data on those IP addresses and just making sure that they weren't seen. Like I said, I'm sure Cloud DNS has fixed this issue, although I don't know that for sure. But worth a look.
Yeah. Outside that, you could also just block Cloud DNS as well.
Yeah, you could. But yeah, any DNS that's not coming from your DNS, your central DNS, just block it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could whitelist yours, but you could do a specific blacklist for that as well.
That's right.
And just on top of that. So why don't you go ahead and cut my interrupt there where I started introducing.
Oh, I'm going to. Don't you. Worry.
Okay. All right, and our last article should be a quick one here. Suspect arrested in ransom your employer criminal scheme. So if you remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about an attacker who was emailing employees saying, hey, why don't you install this malware and I'll give you a cut of the take for the ransom that I get from your company from this. So this article comes to us from ZDNet. And it's actually an article about an article from Krebs, which is kind of ridiculous that these kind of things even exist. Because I got most of this stuff from the Krebs article. But the original thing was that he was going to give you a 40% cut, which was going to get net someone about 2.5 million in Bitcoin. So these guys from Abnormal Security said, hey, well, let's see what happens if we try to get in on this. Once they started talking to the guy, he haggled him down to 120,000 from 2.5 million is all you were going to get from the scheme. This fellow from Nigeria, I cannot even begin to pronounce his name. You can look at it in the article from Krebs. But he was trying to build a social network in Nigeria because apparently they banned Twitter. And he's trying to build this as kind of a Twitter replacement. So this whole scheme was for him to get money to build this to go legit within Nigeria with this social network. And he collected his targeting data from LinkedIn. And this was interesting that he decided that he was going to target all senior level executives to target for the scheme. Which is kind of ridiculous because those are the last people I think you should target with a scheme like this. Because they're less likely to be disgruntled or slip through the cracks or be incentivized by this kind of payoff. Yeah. But when he was arrested, he said weeks after he started the marketing ploy for this, he didn't get anybody to take him up on the offer. But as soon as he got busted by Krebs, as his name appeared in the media, he started receiving thousands of inquiries from people interested in the idea.
That doesn't surprise me. I've never understood kind of why people risk their lives and their livelihoods for such minor amounts of money, but $1 million is pretty good. I mean, I don't think I do it for anything less than 6 million myself, but we all got a price.
Yeah. Well, I think most of those thousands though were probably security researchers. Versus people who are actually interested in taking him up on his offer. Yeah. So more like the guys from Abnormal Security.
It was a bunch of influencers trying to get new content.
Who knows? Maybe they're trying to get in on the ground floor of his social media network or whatever.
Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.